Hi, this is Joey, and I turned 8 years old this week. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. Great show, Daddy.
Thanks, JoJo. That's my youngest son, Joey, who turned 8 this week. Happy birthday, buddy. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is wonderful to be here with you today for show number 986. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN Radio studio. So hello to Bob. And yeah, it was a great week. Joey turning 8. And it's just so much fun for me to watch him grow up, to have fun, to learn, to just be a kid. And the cool thing about being a kid is that you are resilient. You get knocked down and you get back up because, hey, you want to keep playing the game, right? You want to keep hanging out with your friends. You want to keep living life. Kids go through a lot, and that can be a good thing because it does build resiliency. Chicago has been through a lot, too, when you think about it. We've seen our fair share of hard times, fires, factories closing, violence that makes headlines across the country. And now here we are talking about this possibility of federal troops being sent into our city. And just saying that out loud kind of feels weird. I mean, soldiers on the same streets where kids like Joey ride their bikes, where neighbors hold block parties, where people are going to work every morning. But we've seen that Chicago doesn't crumble when times get tough, you know? I think we've always found a way through, not necessarily because of some magic from City Hall or Washington, D.C., but because of the people who live here. The ones who look out for their block, the ones who are keeping the trains moving to make sure our kids are getting to school, who check in on the folks next door. It's the community where the strength of this city has always come from. And no matter what happens, no matter who threatens to divide us, Chicago, I think, will stand. Because resilience isn't just part of our history, it's who we are. We've got a great show for you today. We get the secret history of a local jazz musician. We get an update on how we can run for office. We need that now more than ever. And we'll learn about a new way to get a peek into the state of Illinois' finances. The financial health of Illinois is something we might not think about on a daily basis, but it does impact our lives as residents of the state. The Fiscal Futures Project at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois analyzes budget data from across the state. Recently, they launched a new online data hub that is a central resource for accessible, research-ready public policy data. David Merriman is a professor of public policy at UIC, and he's also the head of the Fiscal Futures Project. He is here with us today to talk about this new data hub. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. So Fiscal Futures, and we've talked about this on this program before, it's a project that exists to really shine a light on Illinois' finances. So let's drill down here on this new data hub. What exactly can we find there?
Well, what the Fiscal Futures Project has been going up for almost 20 years, and we have data actually going back to 1998 up until the most recent data from fiscal 2024. And it tells you about the Illinois expenditures and revenues in a number of categories, and it does that in a consistent fashion. So it's the actual revenues and expenditures across all the funds in that the state of Illinois has. There's hundreds of funds. So we look beyond just the general fund. And so you can also easily calculate the growth rates of both revenues and expenditures So that's basically what it is. You can download the data and do, you know, whatever kind of analysis you want. So it helps you talk about the fiscal condition of the state.
Yeah, and what I like about it, and again, this is up at igpa.uillinois.edu. We will link up to it, this new data hub from the Fiscal Futures Project. I like it because it's very user-friendly, and I think we might hear, oh boy, fiscal data from a state, how exciting is that, or I'm not going to be able to decipher this information, but this is something where you can go onto the website, and there's an online chart and graph there. And you can kind of click what you want to see. Is it how much we're spending on aging? Is it agriculture down the line? So that's part of it. This, we want to emphasize, this is pretty user-friendly.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Thank you. Yes, it is user-friendly. It calculates what we call compound annual growth rates. So that sort of the growth rates, and you can compare them across different revenues and expenditure categories. And it's just, it's, you know, point and click kind of interface. You can also look at them for different sequences of years. And we hope that will be informative to people.
So how did you go about collecting this data? Because when I talk to folks who do these big data projects, I'm always amazed at how they're able to take all of this information, which doesn't always get delivered or collected in a very organized and easy to understand way, and turn it into something that is organized and easy to understand for the rest of the public. How did you do this data collection process?
Well, thanks for asking that. Yes. It has been a very, very long process. We've worked with various comptrollers in the state of Illinois, and they've been very cooperative. They send us at the end of each fiscal year a very complicated, long computer output that shows basically all of the expenditures of the state in many different funds. Those funds aren't really very meaningful to the average person. And so what we've done is we've assembled the funds, added the funds up into categories that make more sense, like, you know, how much have we gotten in cigarette taxes, or how much have we gotten in different kinds of federal aid, whether it's for transportation or for Medicaid, et cetera. And we've been very careful about making it consistent from year to year, so that even when the funds change, even though the money that's supporting a particular activity might come in through lots of different avenues, we've worked hard to assemble them in a consistent set. And so that's what we've done. And we have a lot of communication with the comptroller to make sure that we're understanding the data right.
So who do you see benefiting from that data? Because you said that anyone can go onto this website, this new data hub, and you can do your own analysis and click on what areas of spending and revenue that you want to see. Is this for journalists? Is this for politicians? Who's going to benefit from this?
Well, we hope lots of different categories of people will benefit. We, you know, state legislators are certainly one of our big audience, that if they want to know what's going on, I think it's a lot easier to look at our data than to try and assemble it themselves, or even looking at the budget. The budget really is much more difficult to interpret because you have lots of different funds and you don't get a consistent time series over time. So the legislators and their staff is a primary audience. Journalists is also an important audience. We hope advocates, people who are pushing for one particular program or another, are trying to understand how spending in their particular area of interest is changing over time. And to some extent, the general public, we realize that, you know, most people are not going to look at this on a regular basis. But we think if they have questions, this is a good place to come and kind of better understand the data. So those are the primary audiences that we're thinking about.
So there's a lot of data, and it's in a user-friendly format. Okay, so let me ask you a quick analysis question here, David, on the spot. I mean, how is Illinois doing? Because I know that we have to balance the budget, but if we look kind of long-term here, are there any trends? Are we doing okay fiscally? Is the future bright? I mean, this is a crazy time because there's so many federal cuts and programs in the state have been impacted by that. So do we know, like, how we're doing and where we're going here?
Well, I think there is a lot that we can say. So, for instance, you know, one of the key graphs that we have is just total expenditures and total revenues over time. And when you look at that graph, we have a line that shows revenue and a line that shows expenditures. And in many years, the expenditures have been above the revenue total. So we've been running deficit. What you saw post-COVID was huge increases in revenue because we got a lot of federal money. And the expenditures didn't go up as fast. So we were running essentially surpluses for a few years. Now that revenue stream has gone down back much more to normal, but we're still got roughly balance in the most recent fiscal year. The real question is what's going to happen in the future. Unfortunately, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think things are going to get tougher because for one thing, you know, we don't know what the state of the economy will be, and that does a lot to drive our revenue. And also there are some federal revenues that are drying up. And we might have real problems with state expenditures as some federal cutbacks come in. So we'll be issuing a report ourselves with our analysis of it. I mean, the current situation is that the state's in really pretty good fiscal shape this year. We have concerns about a number of things in the next few years, and we will have more about that out in the next couple of months.
All right. Well, we'll look for that analysis from the Fiscal Futures Project. That is a part of the University of Illinois, the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at that institution. And David Merriman is a professor of public policy at UIC, and he is the head of the Fiscal Futures Project. That website, again, is igpa.uillinois.edu. And if you can't remember that, we will link up to that through our website. Hey, David, always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your insight.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you.
Are some big issues happening in our society right now, I would say. And we are in a time when strong, sensible leadership is needed. But that means we need candidates to run for office. Back in May of this year, on Outside the Loop number 971, I chatted with Tom Tresser. He's a local civic activist and educator, and he's also an organizer with the 100K Project, which aims to get 100,000 people to run for local office during these crazy times. Right now, we'll hear part of my conversation with Tom and then get an update on what he's up to. So right now, let's rewind to May of this year.
I'm a student of the far right, okay? So maybe your listeners know, because we've been around the bend a few times, you're so nice to have me on your show. I used to be a Shakespearean actor, don't you know?
Right.
And I used to be a theater producer. I was very successful. One of the most successful off-loop theaters. Twice I had three shows running at the same time. So this was in the 80s going up to 1990. But in 1990, I learned about the attacks coming up on the National Endowment for the Arts, the NEA. The NEA, for those of you that don't know, is America's national funding for the arts. You know, it's our premier cultural organization. The right wing, under the Christian Coalition, attacked these artists with direct mail, speeches from the Senate, editorializing, and to their various pulpits. These artists and their colleagues were unchristian, they were unpatriotic, they were filth, and they were perverting America. And it was such hateful language. And with that political speaking, they sort of sullied the waters for funding of the arts in America to this day. So that's one byproduct. But the real payoff for these nuts were all the people that's responded to their direct mail and rallies and whatnot were sent to be trained. And they set up several institutions for doing this. One of them is called the Leadership Institute. I invite your listeners to Google it and spend a few minutes. You'll see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
They have trained now 350,000 people to lead in public life, but as conservatives. That is to say, people who do not believe in the rule of law or the, I would say, the government helping people or DEI or any of that stuff. And in the true American fashion, they organized, got people to run, they got the votes, and they govern. Now they have both houses of the Congress, the Supreme Court, and the presidency. And that's from 40 years of patient organizing, messaging, vote building, and suppressing the other side. So they're boosting their side and suppressing the other side. 40 years, and I've watched it all unfold like a slow motion train wreck. So all the 100K project is just an appeal to us. I mean, basically, if you're listening to this broadcast, I'm talking to you. You run for office, you know, and I'm talking library board, school board, not Congress. You know, it's in the Chicago market, that's a big ask. But in most of America, you know, a run for even state representative is kind of, you know, within the realm of doing, you know, especially school board and library boards, because these right-wing nuts have been moving on those bodies for years.
And that's where change really happens. I mean, we talk about why local offices, but the ability to affect really more immediate change, because people become annoyed with politics and the system because, oh, it moves so slowly. But this is something where you can make a difference in your backyard and really see this happen.
Yes, but that's where we live. That's where your property taxes. That's where your kids go to school. That's where you go to church. That's where you shop. So if your roads don't work, if the police are not doing what they should be doing, if the parks suck, if you can't file to get a permit because you want to start a construction project because it's all messed up. This is where all happens, right in your city, your municipality, and your county, and of course, obviously, the state writ large.
If people are interested here, the website is, again, 100kproject.us, the number 100kprojectus, because you're looking for 100,000 people to get elected here. So how does this work? People get in touch with you. What kind of training do you provide?
Right. So we are working on that. I myself have trained dozens and dozens of people to run for office from our creative world. So it's my assertion that when our creative crew runs and we serve as servant leaders, we change the civic space around us. And we do things that our normal friends, like the guy who works for the real estate company, you know, who runs for office, or the veteran, or the sheriff, or the guy who used to work for the guy. These are the people that typically hold office. And they have their way, and I'm saying our creative crew does it better.
That clip from Outside the Loop number 971 from May of this year, featuring Tom Tresser. He is a local civic activist and educator and organizer with the 100K Project. And there's some news from that project. According to Tom, he says, quote, in an email to me, he says, through the cooperation of the 100K Project, the National Guild for Community Arts Education, and the Cleveland Arts Education Consortium, a detailed 8-week leadership and candidate training program will be offered online in 8 weekly 2-hour sessions starting Thursday, October 9th. The program is designed to show attendees that they have a vast array of values, skills, and experiences that are highly needed in public life in America right now. Attendees will be shown how their creative and nonprofit-related experiences can translate into winning campaigns for public office at all levels, end quote. So there you go. We will link up to the 100K Project on our website. And the website that you can go to is 100kproject.us. Hey, I think this is a great thing, and Tom is doing some really important work, and I'm happy to highlight that work, and we need people to run for office and lead us in the right direction. Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
the secret history of Chicago music.
Yeah, once again connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of Steve Krakow, who is the author of the Secret History of Chicago Music column in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. And he is also a local musician and music historian, and he has the story this week of a very interesting musician, very cool guy by the name of Henry Threadgill. So two things here, Steve. First of all, that name is awesome. And secondly, this is a rare back-to-back secret history for us here.
It is. We kind of jumped a week, we skipped a week, and we kind of ended up with a couple back-to-back. Just how the flow went of reader content. I think there was like a big weed story they ran 1 week or something like that. So, but here we are.
Here we are. And that's what matters, of course. And yes. Henry Threadgill, man. So, okay, just killer name and a killer musician. He was born in Chicago and he is playing jazz. But this is, and you and I have talked about this before, thinking about, I don't know if avant-garde's the right term for it, but it's not like straightforward traditional jazz, I guess you could say. He's kind of out there.
Yeah, he's versed in that, in traditional jazz, and like a lot of musicians, I think he was exposed to all different kinds of music. I thought it was interesting. I didn't even know, like I say, I always learned something. He played in like polka bands for a minute, which and I even read that, that kind of music and the sort of modalities and intervals and all that stuff of which it's played made an impact on him. So, it's the music around you sort of shapes you and that you grow up in. And, his dad was like a gambler and kind of worked for the mob and was into jazz. His mom went to church and was into the church music. And I feel like it all made, just sort of like a huge impression on him and, became this stew of something that's just completely unique. And like you said, you could call it avant-garde. Some called it the new jazz, some called it fire music when it first came out, but it was basically looking to guys like John Coltrane and Sun Ra who just sort of increased the vocabulary of jazz. It didn't have to be one guy takes a solo, one guy takes a solo, one guy takes a tasty solo, we're done. It was more yeah. like what this music has infinite possibilities. And he's obviously a very heady, intelligent guy who saw those possibilities.
Right. So he is born in February of 1944 in Chicago, and he lives in Bronzeville. He grows up there. And like you said, he's going to church. His mom was involved with the church, and he is sort of steeped in this music, and the church had a big influence on him. And that's going to propel him to 1958, where he's on Maxwell Street, and he kind of has like an awakening of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, I think like he was encouraged, when playing in a church band to get people to freak out, like the best church music does that, like it kind of rises, makes you rise to this other level, to sort of, whatever. So there was that. And then, yeah, he was going to Maxwell Street with his mom, who was, I think, just shopping for the family and seeing these incredible blues musicians, so that was yet another thing that was, like a factor in, he's trying to play like boogie woogie music and stuff. So I feel like it was all in there. And then, yeah, going to see very traditional sort of jazz guys like Stan Getz and Chet Baker, his mom took him to go see, and that blew his mind.
Yeah. And he is going to start playing in the Inglewood High School band. So he's playing percussion. He's one of these guys that plays a few things. I mean, he's so good. He starts on percussion. He takes up the clarinet and the saxophone. And so this is a story of kind of this, you know, guy, Henry Threadgill, who is a multi-instrumentalist. And I think you're right. Like, his intelligence just shines through the music.
Yeah. And I think also, you know, a lot of these guys were very interested in composition and, you know, how, you know, like composing in this way beyond classical music, beyond modern music, beyond, you know, integrating all these things. And I think he was one of these guys, and he was very fortunate that he sort of hooked up with like the most like-minded individuals in Chicago, aka the AACM, the Association for Advancement of Creative Musicians, which birthed so many incredible, you know, artists and musicians, and as an institution to this day. And I think he sort of found his people.
Out of there, you see this sort of Afrocentric, sometimes experimental jazz. And we've talked about that before, you know, thinking about like Sun Ra, of course, is a big one. Something along those lines where it's heady, it's out there, but part of this larger tradition that was forming of this Afrocentrism.
Totally. And yeah, and you know, Sun Ra started playing initially, you know, very sort of traditional big band jazz, you know, and a lot of these guys were, you know, sort of came out of that and just evolved to something more. And a lot of these guys, I feel like 50 years later, people understand it, you know, like I think when people heard Coltrane or even like Charlie Parker, you know, like guys, you know, or Thelonious Monk and these guys who are, you hear it now and you're like, this is nice music, you know, like, sure. It's breaking out of form a little bit, but it's really nice. You hear John Coltrane playing India and My Favorite Things, and it's beautiful. You know, at the time, people were freaking out. People were like, you can't do that. You know, what are you doing? Why are you doing these atonal parts? And it's like, well, that's actually in class. You know, people freaked out when the Rite of Spring was first performed, you know, in the day, because it had atonal parts. So when you look at sort of like the, you know, wider history of music, people don't. And then another thing is Americans don't always get it. And these guys got to go to Europe to get appreciated, or New York. And we lose a lot of our good musicians. And that sort of happened to Henry. But at the same time, he's always collaborated. And the AACM sort of set up a New York office because obviously, you know, jazz and sort of avant-garde and progressive jazz flourished there. So it was almost like a full-on organization of, you know, chapter AACM Chicago and there, where these musicians could sort of collaborate and, you know, take it further.
So he is, I mean, we talked about Sun Ra. He is hanging out in clubs. He is listening to some rehearsals when it comes to Sun Ra and some experimental music. And he, he's in the 1960s here. He ends up going into the military. He goes to Vietnam, really kind of at the height of just the worst fighting in Vietnam. So yeah. Where does he go from here? Because he is playing, he's meeting a lot of people. He's getting influenced. He is making a name for himself as this composer. How does this story continue in the 60s and in the 70s?
Well, yeah, so he kind of, his buddies actually kind of got him out of his service by saying, you know, he was going to teach, which he did, thankfully, because yeah, he kind of went into the army to like compose and like be in the army band, and it worked for a bit, but then found himself kind of like in the middle of some of the worst action, you know, of the war. So came back, you know, just, I feel like he continued his path, like sort of hooked up with, you know, a lot of his old cohorts and even new ones in Chicago who like shared his vision. He was doing like this music for like theater groups and stuff like that. And more or less he lays the seeds for forming this band Air. And that is the band he is most known for. And they got such a buzz, like, I guess they didn't even try to get signed by labels. Labels were just after them. And it kind of started out of them started transcribing Scott Joplin music, which is piano. And there was no one playing piano in the band. So it was initially a sort of very novel concept. And, you know, it sort of became its own unique thing. And pretty much he ended up moving that whole band of Chicago musicians to New York.
Yeah, he goes to New York by 1975, Henry Threadgill. But he's keeping his, as you say here, his Chicago ties alive. He maintains his contacts here. What's going to happen to him? Because he is, I mean, his career, we should say, is really long. He's going to form more groups. He's going to play with other people. So where does this guy go in the latter half of the 20th century?
I do got to say it was very hard to condense. You know, again, a guy, titanic career, known in the jazz circles, but I felt like general public doesn't know about him.
Sure.
And he has a new album out, and I was like, oh, great. You know, this is a great excuse to sort of talk about him. And yeah, just a huge career. Luckily, my editor was able to find a little more room because he's a fan as well, and was like able to find a little more room to even like I kind of focused more on his Chicago years and skimped a little on some of the later bands he did in New York. But Mr. Philip Montoro filled in some of the blanks, and he had his own quartet, you know, for a while, quintet. And then he had another band called Very, Very Circus.
Okay.
Which sounds super heady. I like indescribable music, basically. Started his own band. Yeah, another thing called X75. You know, there's tubas in the mix on some of these bands. There's like two tubas in Very, Very Circus. And then he had this other band called Zoo. I don't even know how to pronounce it, honestly. Zooid?
Zooid? Zooid? Yeah, I don't know.
Zooid?
Z-O-O-I-D.
Yeah, you know, and my editor, Philip, he's a fan. He saw him, actually. He's seen Zooid, so maybe I got to ask him. But, yeah, you know, so, like, just seems unstoppable. He wrote a memoir, like, a couple of years ago, and definitely, you know, and just put out a new album in his 80s, you know? So, like, just what a guy, you know?
Yeah, he's what, 81 now, I think?
Yeah, he's one of the very few jazz musicians to win a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, he won a Pulitzer Prize for music in 2016. I didn't know that you could win a Pulitzer Prize for music.
It is a pretty rare thing, but when you start looking at the sort of rich tapestry of, you know, just like every form of music that he's touched on and people he's inspired, and just what a career, you know. Again, I think in like 20, 30 years, people will be like, oh, yep, I get it now. You know, like I see exactly Zooid, Tutu. It makes perfect sense. You were just leading the way for this new form of music that's now just like a completely established form, you know?
Yeah, well, hey, he's ahead of his time. We're talking about Henry Threadgill, composer. He plays the sax, the clarinet. He is he does percussion. He is a really cool musician, a very fascinating story, I think. And we can get the whole story in the Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. Steve Krakow is the author of that strip. And he's also a local musician and music historian and artist, and he hand draws a picture of whoever he's profiling. So you get a nice picture of Henry Threadgill in there, Steve. And as always, I say thank you so much for your time, man. Thanks for all your hard work. And let's get weird and heady with it, man. Let's just get out there with some of this jazz.
Check out his new album, Listen Ships. It's got like group of like four or five guitarists on it. Let's just say it's gonna blow your mind.
And that'll do it. Outside the Loop show number 986 is done. I say thank you for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering help in the WGN radio studio. Have a great week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.